Welcome to If You Know Your History on FNR Football Nation Radio. I'm your host, Paul Mavridis, and with me is Ian Sison. And Ian, sorry for the false start there. We're just lucky I had the chat box open because our producer is sort of like gone mute.
We've lost our sound.
Well, that's okay.
From mission control.
How are you doing, Ian?
What am I doing? I'm okay. I need a shave. I need a haircut. Look at that. It's so long.
I want to see mine then.
Yeah, I'll show us.
No. I got a knock at the door. The doorbell went about 20 minutes ago.
Yeah.
And it was the postie. And he delivered this.
Wow. From hope to glory.
40 years of Croatia Deakin Soccer Club.
And that so was sent to me. What's the glory? What's the glory?
Well, actually, I just had a quick flip through it. And actually, the reason it's called From Hope to Glory is because the club was made to change its name to a neutral, non-ethnic name back in the 60s.
Oh, okay.
And I chose the Hope Soccer Club.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Because if they've never won anything...
Oh, well, they've won stuff.
Okay, because I was going to say they could be called Power Without Glory. But
Yeah, I'm sure they'd love that. So I bought that off Greg Stark. He had a spare copy, and I'm like, yeah, I'll take that off your hands. Mm. So... he's been rummaging around his garage as he is wont to
rummaging.
Do.
I wouldn't mind rummaging around Greg's garage.
Oh, I'm sure you'll find a lot of stuff there.
Yeah.
Probably mostly to do with New South Wales, so I've no concern to me.
Oh, stop it. You're concerned with all of it, Paul. It's
as long as the people who care about it, are concerned with it, that's what matters.
Yep.
Keep local history local.
Well, how big's the locality, though? That's the issue.
Mm.
Can Australia be a locality?
No.
Yes, it can?
No.
Well, come on. This is a theoretical argument, but how big's the locality?
There's a potato cake line. There's a Barassi line.
And there's a Palmer line.
Well, yeah. Well, that Mildura. I won't go into that. Usually we start off with the cleanup with the Mark Borich Express, but can we sort of do a little something a little bit before that? And the reason you call it the Mark Borich Express is because you are reminded of sort of a play on the Kevin Borich Express.
Yeah.
Some 70s, 80s, I don't know, jam.
Kiwi musician who came to Australia and was very popular to set up a band called the La-Di-Das.
And... you know, never really thought much of the Kevin Borich Express myself, but I was reading through a Walter Pless 8 Things We Learned This Weekend article from a couple of weeks ago. And item number 7 was the passing of Tim Partridge, former Caledonians player and brilliant musician. And it turns out that Tim Partridge was a member of the Kevin Borich Express from 1976 to 1980.
It's fabulous. I mean, it's not fabulous that he's died, but it's a fabulous sort of convergence.
That's right. Yeah. He according to Walter's blog here, Tim Partridge played for Caledonians, now Kingborough Lions United, back in the late 60s and early 70s before concentrating on his music career. His son also played for Caledonians.
Does that suggest that he's Scottish?
Maybe.
Because then we've got one more Scottish migrant helping to produce some of the great Australian rock.
Might have to ask Walter about that because they went to school together as well. And he would attend as well. I mean, matches in Tasmania up until his passing as well. So there's a little link we didn't know about.
This is tremendous.
Again, that Australian music soccer nexus, especially if it's Scottish, we'll have to get a clarification on that at some point. Kind of interesting thing. To the Mark Borich Express, and Mark has been uploading some things as well, and I think he's looking at, he's spent a lot of time lately on his archives in terms of Moorabbin and Richmond
Yep.
So we might see some interesting stuff there in terms of transfer movements, lists, and that kind of thing. I think he put on some Socceroo programs against the Solomon Islands in 2005. And more or less, that's pretty much, I think, most of his activity. But he's, I think he's focusing on cleaning out his archives a bit.
He also revealed that he, for 3 minutes, shared the field with the son of an AFL great and another Tasmanian, Brent Croswell.
Mm.
Yeah, that was sort of interesting. And Walter used to tell me about sitting with Brent Croswell at KGV watching his son play.
Mm.
Yeah, it's an interesting story there. And Brent Croswell used to bemoan what had happened to footy and was pleased that his son was playing soccer.
That's kind of, I mean, it'd be interesting to get a whole collection of those people that, you know, played Australian rules rugby league and get their views on their sons or daughters playing soccer.
Yeah.
As opposed to the home sport, if you will, the sport they sort of made their living from.
Yeah.
I mean, there might be something for another list to go through.
Yeah, well, I mean, I can think of several. I can think, well, Hurd for a start, but then his son's gone back to footy. Was it his other son done that?
I mean, I think they bounced around from a few clubs.
Right.
At the junior level. I know they were at South Melbourne at one point, then at Port Melbourne. And I kind of lost track of it. Once they leave South, I don't.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, you're a historian. You are. Your view is broader than you claim. Stop it.
Anyway, speaking of people with broad kind of interest, George Katanis is still doing interviews and he's pumping them out like there's no tomorrow. It's ridiculous. So he's got a Ross Aloisi one coming up. He's done a Ben Roach one from the from the Pararoos, and he just does an end with Cotty. He's just got into his groove now, so keep an eye out on My World Is Round.
Mm.
Facebook, YouTube pages, a lot of great content. I'm looking forward to the Ian Dobson interview. But yeah, keep up the good work, George. Last week we spoke just really quickly about, well, not quickly, I spent a bit of time on it, on Wikipedia as sort of foreshadowing a possible future sort of analysis discussion about what we do with that Australian soccer. And Tony Pasoglia, and this actually ties in with the other topic we had last week, which we had, I think we had looking at the Slavia photo from 1964. And Mark Borich sort of admonished everybody who ever talks about that Slavia team for not mentioning that Peter Aldous was a member of that team, an FA Cup winner with Aston Villa.
Right.
You know, look, mea culpa, that's the kind of thing that should be brought up more often. You know, have this hugely credentialed player playing in the Victorian State League in the 1960s. Kind of ridiculous situation. And Tony's gone and just done his little edit to Peter Aldous's Wikipedia page. You know, it's just a paragraph, but that is important. One day we might even have the proper stats for it, for his appearances. Saying, well, he came to this club, then he went to that club, then he went to that club. That's enough. That's part of that. We've just added value to that Wikipedia article. Tony's added value to the Australian soccer content on the most popular source of information on the internet. So well done to Tony. And it, again, shows how easy it is to do it. If just it'll probably take you like 10, 15 minutes to just knock out maybe two or three of these paragraphs. So we'll keep an eye out for these kinds of things coming up. I had left my internet archive project to sit for a week while I was doing some other things. And at the moment I've got three collections and about, I think it's about nearly 300 items that I've uploaded to it. And I've had a look at the views, and with almost zero promotion that these collections exist, one's for National Soccer League programs, one's for yearbooks, and one's for newspapers, magazines, and fanzines. They've got a collective view count of about 300, actually over 300, which I am kind of shocked by. Who is looking for this stuff and who's finding it? I'm really intrigued.
And if you start promoting it on Facebook and Twitter, who knows?
Yeah, and look, obviously I want to get to a stage where I have a real bulk of material on there, so it's not just a poor cousin to the stuff that Mark Boric has done.
Yeah.
You really got to get it to a point where it is close enough to equal to what he's done in those categories.
It's going to be very hard to exceed the wealth of Mark's
site. You can't do it. But it's got to be at least comparable.
Yeah.
So that'll take a lot of time.
Yeah.
But I'm pleased that people are finding this material and actually using it. And I can see which files I've been looking at as well, which is nice. But just the fact that people look at the collections, that it is of its own volition almost drawing a crowd of some sort. So I'm quite happy about that.
I did my research for 100 years ago today, and I've always noticed that it says newspapers and gazettes.
Mm-hmm.
And I've never really focused on the gazettes. The gazettes are just information that's been produced by the government in various states or nationally. And I thought, I'll click on it. I clicked on it. And so I've done a search for soccer and gazettes, and I limited it to the 1920s. And I've found these amazing bits of information, and I'm not sure the extent to which this source is going to be revealing of lots of information, but I found a few really interesting things. And the first one, I put them in two categories, theft and copyright. And the first category is theft. And this is from the New South Wales Police Gazette on the 24th of August, 1921. Burglaries, etc. Cessnock, stolen between 7:30 the 13th and 11 a.m. the 14th instant from the ambulance hall Cessnock, the property of Alfred Henry Price, residing at Mayfield Street, Cessnock. A silver tenor horn, brass worn off first valve and also near where right thumb grips. Boozy and Company Maker, England, stamped thereon. In a black leather case, value £30. That's a lot of money back then. We're talking like thousands of dollars today. It's identifiable. And this is the kicker. Suspicion attached to a team of soccer footballers from Balgowney. So the Balgowney, Judy Masters has come up and stolen a horn.
Did you follow that up on Wrestling Trove? Or
I did try to find that game. Balgowney was still active in the Gardner Cup at this stage. They played the semi-final after this, so I imagine they beat Cessnock. But I couldn't find reference to that game. If they went up to play Cessnock, maybe they stayed in Cessnock, but they played in Western.
It's almost like a bit like the Facebook, the Victoria Police, the police Facebook pages, you know, have you seen this item kind of thing, or even like the suburban papers, you know, it's where you see a lot of these, like the crime roundup.
Yeah. Well, this is very much the crime roundup, but so this is a mystery already, you know, the first mystery for the show today. What happened about that? Did they find anybody from Balgowney, these terrible Balgowney people in the southern coast, south coast? Anyway, I'll move on. New South Wales Police Gazette and Weekly Record of Crime, 19th of December, 1923. It's a bit random. It's just the 20s.
Mm-hmm.
And Ida May, who lived at 66 Hugo Street, Redfern, was robbed. And there's a whole list of things that were taken: a gold oval wristlet watch, a silver open-faced keyless wristlet watch, so on, so on, so on. But what I'm really interested in is this: a gold medal, winner of second division soccer, Pyrmont Rangers, G. Robinson. I'm back. A gold medal for mark of esteem from the Pyrmont Football Club. I'm back. A gold medal, winners of First League Pyrmont 1918, G. Robinson, on back. A gold medal, winners of Sunlight Cup, won by Pyrmont, C. Robinson, on back. a gold medal, 100 yard brace handicap won by C. Robinson on back. So they're playing other sports as well.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a mark of esteem from Piermont Rangers to C. Robinson. And then further down, a square nickel match, a gold medal, winner of Sunlight Cup, Piermont E. Robinson on back. So we've got all these different Robinson brothers, relatives playing for Piermont. And it's a record of their good play, and it's a record of the championships they've won.
Yes.
And it's a source of information that we might not find, might not be available elsewhere.
And she knows very well what is in this. She's on top of, look, here are the 50 different things they've stolen. And by the way, I know all the inscriptions.
Yeah, that's astounding, isn't it? All right, well, I'll move on.
It's a bit suspicious. Another
burglaries, and this is 1929. And this is three gold medals, shield with a soccer football in front of blue and gold, Canterbury Junior Premiers, A.W. Brinkley on back. A gold medal, soccer football in front, CDB, five-a-side competition, C.W. Brinkley on back. So there we go. We've got Canterbury Juniors won the premiership at some point. We don't actually know when.
Mm.
So, you know, we know Brinkley played, A.W. Brinkley and C.W. Brinkley played for Canterbury at some point. So, again, more information. The final crime one is the stolen between 3:30. This is July 25. Stolen between 3:30 and 4 p.m. So they've got that fairly well worked out. On the 18th instant from the finance room at the Royal Agricultural Society Showgrounds, Sydney, the property of the Metropolitan Soccer Football Association, the sum of £185, not identifiable. And £185 in today's terms is $15,000. So I'm thinking a club like the club I'm familiar with, Clifton Hill. Imagine they for some reason kept 15 grand in the canteen overnight and someone knocked it off. That's it would be a blow for the club. It'd be a substantial blow, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it's like 1 week's wages in the NPL nowadays.
Yeah. Yeah. That's these are all little mysteries that provide us information, historical information, but also they urge me to find out, you know, the outcome.
Because the Gazette is the kind of thing that we kind of I don't think any of us have really looked at too much. We kind of dismiss it, we go straight for the newspapers.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm going to, like I did with the newspapers, I have to learn how to search.
Mm.
I have to learn the tricks. I've got to teach myself new tricks for searching. I've tried British Association football. That didn't work. There's not a lot of soccer before the 20s.
Mm-hmm.
I think I found one thing before the 20s that was directly soccer. So I've got to teach myself how to do it better. Look, I'll move on to the second aspect, which is copyright. And this is the Commonwealth of Australia Gazette. Proceedings under the Copyright Act, a list of applications for the registration of the copyright in literary, including musical and dramatic and artistic works, and the performing rights in musical and dramatic works under the Copyright Act 1912. And this is the 1st of October to the 31st of December 1926. And there's a whole list of copyright applications, and this is the one that's interesting for us. 15495, Trodel and Cooper Proprietary Limited, Bank Place, Melbourne. Do you know where Bank Place is?
Not at the top of my head.
Sheet of letterpress, rules of the soccer game, football, illustrated, 15th of October 1926. So somebody has published the rules of soccer in 1926 in Melbourne. That'll be a bit of a collector's item too, I imagine, if you could find it.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure Greg has one.
So that's going to set me on a little task. And the second one, again, proceedings under the Copyright Act, the 1st of April to the 30th of June 1925. And this one will tickle you, I think. 18863 Vincent Surrey Smith, 98 Carhalton Street. And I'm not sure if that's right. Croydon Park, Sydney, New South Wales. It's a game. Rules of table soccer game.
Ooh.
15th of June, 1925. So there's a table soccer game.
So if they've copyrighted this, would there be this stuff would be in the patent office as well?
It made me realise that I don't quite understand older copyright law. I understand contemporary copyright law. I don't know. We need to maybe need to find that out. Imagine there's a little Australian table soccer game sitting there in some dusty box somewhere. Quite amazing. Well, anyway, so that's...
Maybe that's something we've got to look up then. We've got to follow through and look up Australian patent database. Yes.
Yep. All right.
Well, who knows how far back they actually go.
Yeah. Well, let's see what we can find. Yep. Just one more thing. Todd Blackwell from Newcastle, one of our listeners, he asked me how the role of honours, the search for the role of honour is going, the Meriwether Advanced Role of Honour. And to be honest, it's not really going anywhere. I think we've lost it for good. But there was COVID has interrupted a process that was underway, and that was the reconstruction of that role of honour. And it was going to be timed for Anzac Day this year. So hopefully we do the same process next year. And so sorry, Todd, that's all I can say, all I can tell you at the moment.
Time for a break?
Yeah.
Okay, we'll see you soon.
Welcome back to If You Know Your History on Football Nation Radio with Ian Sison and Paul Mavridis. Now it's time for
100 Years Ago Today.
Yeah, I heard that.
I heard it too. That's excellent. Everything's lifting. Well, 100 years ago today was the 24th of September, 1920. And it was a good day.
Was it?
Oh, I think so. I mean, every day's a good day. But what I last week we had a terrific session with Sam Lewis, and unfortunately I had to cut the 100 years ago day short a little, focusing on more on women's football. And what I forgot to do was this one, and it's important to us, I think, because it's about Walter Williams, who was killed in a game. And on Saturday, the 18th of September, a friendly game of British Association football was played between Northumberland and Durham and Preston clubs at Middle Park in aid of funds for erecting a memorial tombstone to Walter William Williams, who died from injuries received in the game between these two teams on June 19. A satisfactory amount was received as a result of a collection taken up on the ground. Teams representing Windsor and Osborne House submarine clubs played a return match, or whatever. At halftime, Windsor had kicked 1-0. So it's telling us the halftime score in a friendly match. Anyway.
Well, they don't tell us the amount raised.
Sorry?
They don't tell us the amount. Which is kind of strange.
They'd raised 50 quid by halftime. Anyway, so we're still in the process of tracking down this tombstone. I did get an email from someone involved in the Coburg Cemetery Committee.
Yep.
So I'll follow that up. Now, let's go all the way to Western Australia. The Albany Dispatch, Denmark Notes.
Can I just make a quick note? Dispatch is I've never heard of that as a newspaper title.
Yeah.
Advertiser and
yeah.
District News and all sorts of combinations, Examiner and whatnot, but never Dispatch.
Yeah. Well, this one's interesting because it's not about soccer. Well, it's not directly about soccer. Denmark Notes. All who are interested in football ought to roll up next Saturday to witness the match between Denmark and Albany. The Australian game is gaining in popularity here, and there is no reason why both soccer and Aussie should not be played with credit to the players and enjoyment to the spectators. So it's code cooperation we're talking about. But there's an interesting point that's being made, is that soccer is established and Australian rules is emergent in this region, which kind of fits with some of the patterns in Perth and beyond.
Didn't we look at this region last year?
Yeah,
and then they had the big overnight stay and the big ball.
And they also, they were grumpy about not being given the right ground, remember? And the they thought the council wasn't being fair to the soccer people. Geez, that's a story that continues today, doesn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. At, for example, I won't say it. All right. Now, well, let's move back over to the East Coast. The Gosford Times and Wyong District Advocate. This is a weird, weird article. Sympathy. We are in deep sympathy with Mr. Darcy Rose in the distressing accident he met with in the football match and hope the injury will not permanently disable his arm. So he's broken his arm badly. What kind of football was it? Football is always a dangerous game, and more particularly rugby football. So we assume from this that Darcy was playing rugby.
Mm-hmm.
You think that's fair?
Yeah.
Now, the Melbourne Association game, 1920, remember, from many points of view, is a far safer game to play and much more interesting game to watch. So they mean Australian rules. The Melbourne Association game. This is one of the confusions for us in our research, the way the that writers use these terms very loosely. A more interesting game to watch. Though for pure football, that is playing with the feet, neither rugby nor association, now does that do your head in, can compare with the British soccer. The wonderful dexterity of feet is a sight worth going miles to see. The cleverness in playing the ball also with the head is remarkable. Then, as regards getting a goal, there can be never be any doubt, for a big net is fastened to the upright posts and the crossbar, and the ball is caught in the net below the bar. Obviously, didn't see the 1966 World Cup final.
Obviously, not familiar with all the protests.
Yeah. The goalkeeper is the only player allowed to touch the ball with the hand, for in guarding the goal, he can kick or punch the ball away. There are no scrums and no collaring. To become highly proficient in soccer, one must begin as a boy, as they do at Wall's End, West Wall's End, Adamstown, Young Wall's End, Cessnock, Balmain, etc. Well, this is like Gosford, you know, Central Coast, and Wyong. Where's Wyong? Anyway, it's between Sydney and Newcastle.
Yes.
But it naturalizes the game in these places. But you know, it's a funny list. You've got all the Newcastle teams, then the Maitland team Cessnock, and you've got Balmain. And keep it up year after year. The whole of our district is making anxious inquiry about our esteemed friend, Mr. Darcy Rose, and all wish him a speedy recovery. This article could have been three sentences.
Yes.
But the writer has decided to editorialise about relative merits of different football codes in the middle. And he obviously is a soccer fan. So.
And are we sure that this is always a rugby player?
Well, maybe. I mean, maybe we need to do a bit more digging. Maybe it was.
And which rugby code?
Sorry?
And which rugby code if he is a rugby player?
Well, 1920 in Gosford.
Could be anything.
I don't know. Maybe it'd be rugby union. Anyway, but it's clearly an advocacy of soccer.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, now let's go back west again to the Geraldton, Thursday the 23rd of September. Local and general. British Association Football. Australian-born players of the British Football Association will meet the English-born players at Queen's Park on Saturday afternoon. Australia will be represented by all these guys, and there's Evanson, Armitage, Hardwick, Ariza. And the English will be a whole bunch of English names. As there is a difference of opinion as to the speediest man in the association, a race distance goal to goal of approximately 100 yards will be run off on Saturday prior to the match for a medal suitably inscribed. Okay, and so on and so forth. What's the take out from that?
There's enough Australian players to fill the team.
Yeah, there's enough Australian-born players in Geraldton to form a team.
I mean, thinking to sort of England versus Scotland games,
yeah,
which are sort of held in Victoria, obviously probably around the country as well. Have you ever come across a lot of these kinds of foreign versus native-born games?
I've seen examples sometimes. Yeah, it's
they don't seem to have the same attraction or star quality or promotion.
Yeah, well, it's. I mean, we're talking post-war here.
Mm-hmm.
We know that soccer was pretty big for the Western Australians in the armed forces. It was important. A lot of Western Australian soccer players joined the armed forces. These people might be converts. Some of them might be converts due to the war. Anyway, I thought it was I mean, I've got this affection for Geraldton soccer. It was very strong before the war. And there was a guy called McDonald who was really important. And he joined up. And I've seen no reference to him after 1918. So I worry he died. It's very hard to do a search in the databases because McDonald's not the rarest of names. Yeah, so I need to, you know, I'll get back to him one day. All right.
It's like an interesting kind of like an early development of the, you know, schoolyard skips versus wogs games.
Yeah. Okay, now back to Sydney, the Sun. Cotton Cup contest at Clyde. Well, there's a nice tongue twister. At Clyde Oval tomorrow, the Cotton Memorial Cup will be contested between Cupy and Two Blues. The Cotton Cup is the old Rawson Cup, which was won outright by the Granville District soccer team in 1415. The late Jack Cotton was one of the players. He subsequently enlisted and was killed in France in 1917. The cup was handed to the Granville Association by the team to be competed for locally to perpetuate the memory of their late comrades. That's interesting, changing the name of a trophy.
Mm.
I guess it happens, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, initially it was the Doherty Cup or the Challenge Cup, wasn't it?
Yeah.
There it came.
That was a generic name, though.
Yeah. Yeah. It does happen. We've seen it. Yeah.
Well, a different sport that you might remember in the cricket. My son played in the Hatch.
That's right.
But they changed the name from Hatch to something else.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway.
And now the history gets sort of, I don't know, lost a little bit when that happens. But
yeah,
people are liberty to change the name. It does cause confusion.
Maybe you should set up a trophy change flowchart.
No. I mean, this tends to happen more with sponsor names.
Yeah.
So, you know, obviously throughout the 60s and 70s and 80s, the Ampol Cup was your big pre-season summer cup. But before that, it had a different name because it had a different sponsor.
Yeah.
Probably because in Victoria, I think it was after the Sun Cup, I think it might have been Newspaper Cup.
Yep.
And after the Ampol, it becomes the Buffalo Cup, which is the apparel sponsor. And then it becomes... So these things keep changing names. It does cause confusion as well.
Yeah. There is scope for it, but someone else will have to do the flowchart.
Yeah, I'm not doing it.
Yeah. Because it'd be interesting because you go back to the George and Beanie and they just stop and then new ones start up.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, with the flowchart, I mean, people have been sending me more details now. So I'm going to do a big revision at the end of the year and actually maybe clean it up properly myself because the person I sent it to is not following through.
Now, the final one today, the final 100 years ago today, is from Newcastle, the Newcastle Morning Herald and Miners Advocate. And when I found this, I thought, oh, it's going to be cleared up. Why did they vote against, why did Maitland vote against Newcastle? And I'm halfway through reading it, thinking, oh, this is clearing it up. And then, Okay, Gardner Cup semi-finals. Mr. J.W. Earp. Is that Wyatt? Wyatt Earp writes, in your paper, there appears a reference to a meeting of the New South Wales Soccer Association held in Sydney. The chief business was the selection of grounds on which to play the Gardner Cup semi-finals. Newcastle made an offer for the Western and Balmain Fernley fixture, but when put to the vote, the offer was rejected, and so the game will be played at the Sports Ground, Sydney. Both delegates from the South Maitland Association voted against the acceptance of the Newcastle offer, and it was virtually their vote which placed the game in Sydney. Okay, so that's sort of clarifying, that's what we understood already. A further motion moved by one of the Maitland delegates and seconded by Newcastle received little support and was defeated. Only one Maitland delegate voting for the proposal. Read the Newcastle offer. Maitland delegates did not vote against the offer because the offer was not big enough. And I'm getting completely confused here. That's the reason the game is to be played in Sydney. It was wrongly stated that only one of the Maitland delegates voted for the proposal, or both voted for the game to be played in the Maitland district. And their offer was to give the New South Wales Association the whole of the gate, and for the support it receives, it was just the same as Newcastle received for their offer. So I really don't understand what's even being said there. But I think what's happened, what seems to be happening, is that they wanted the game.
Mm.
It was Western, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, Western. They wanted the game to be played in Maitland. Mm. And when that was refused, they said, well, we're not going to support Newcastle.
Mm.
Do you think that's what's happening there? Because it's really, really confuses me.
Yeah, I can't really get my head around it, to be honest. Maybe one of our listeners can send in an explanation and try to sort it out for us, because I can't.
Maybe
it feels like there's something missing.
Yeah, yeah. Look, I'm going to go to Hetherington and have a look, see what he has to, see what there is about that in this. He might also have something about the thieves from Balgowney. Anyway, that was 100 years ago today. As interesting, I really enjoy doing this. It's good fun, and it feels like a really good way to learn. The intricacies of the culture.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and obviously you go across the country.
Yeah.
So you learn about the intricacies of the culture in very different circumstances.
Yeah.
And look, the Newcastle stuff is absolutely fascinating because there's so much of it.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, the depth of information you get from there and from Maitland and the Hunter is incredible. I mean, the burglary is obviously one thing, but the internal politics, the fact that we have enough information to infer, even if we don't get it spot on, we can infer what was going on.
Whereas Melbourne, we have no clue what on earth is going on. We've got half match reports. We've got
South Australia, even less.
We've got finals that aren't played and we don't know why. Well, we kind of do know why, but why wasn't the Doherty Cup final played?
My big concern, I mean, we've been doing this now for 57 episodes, more or less.
This might be my 50th ball.
Might be. For as long as we've been doing this segment, I think it's just like South Australia seems to be the real...
Yeah.
It doesn't seem to be there.
Yeah.
Every now and again, we get something that's really interesting and it's kind of nice. But I mean, we get more about Geraldton.
Yeah, yeah.
And Albany. More about Northern Tasmania.
Yeah.
I mean, even just the fact that Northern Tasmania, like last week, refuses to go down to Southern Tasmania.
Maybe I need to skew my focus. Look really hard for limited to just South Australian stuff, and really try to. Because it does seem to be a lack of balance there. I mean, we're not balanced against Melbourne because, we're both here in Melbourne. And so this is our primary focus. But the archive's biased against Melbourne. The archive has very little information.
Yes.
Anyway. Look, that was 100 years ago today, and we'll go for a quick break.
If you know your- Welcome back to If You Know Your History on FNR Football Nation Radio with myself, Paul Mavridis. Ian, how are you doing?
I'm going well. I'm trying to find...
What are we talking about now?
Well, this is something I've had
on the back burner for a long time. This is like
in the can for a while. It's a great story. It's a great story because, for several reasons, it's just a nice story in itself. The name of the guy is not. I've just realised the name of the person we're talking about is not in the article. So, but anyway, it's a good story about an interesting person, but it raises the issue of religion and soccer, especially Catholicism. But that's something we can talk about after I read the piece out. It's a piece that I wrote called Religion and Sport, and it comes from the Daily Herald in Adelaide. Oh, here we go, 1913. Okay. The Fighting Parson, the Priest Footballer. The Fighting Parson of Queensland, writes the Melbourne correspondent of the Ballarat Evening Echo, is now widely known, and his views regarding sport and practical demonstrations in amateur competitions have reassured the sporting fraternity, who have laboured according to the utterances of extreme narrow-minded religionists in spheres of damnation, that there is a possibility of them entering the confines of paradise. So there's a debate whether it's possible for religious men to do sport, and especially boxing, I guess, in this instance. So, and the argument seems to be moving to the point that, yes, it is okay for religious men to play sport. Okay. Now comes the news that a young Catholic priest in Melbourne is a soccer player with a reputation. This cleric is a native of Collingwood. I don't think he is. In the way we use the word native, he's from Sydney. But maybe he started in Collingwood, I don't know. The cleric is a native of Collingwood, where he is respected not only by his own sect, but by thousands outside his church, thousands. After leaving school about 7 years ago, the reverend gentleman studied in the Manly College, and that is in Manly in Sydney, and was ordained a priest in due course. While at college, the aspirant for the pulpit, being exceptionally fond of sport of all descriptions, took a liking for soccer, and he developed such a talent for the game that he was considered the crack of the college. Now, this goes against our shared understandings, or older shared understandings, that Catholicism and soccer were not really together. I mean, rugby league was the game of the working class Catholic communities. So it's an interesting take on that. It's an interesting contradiction of the assumptions that we had made. Anyway, he was transferred to Melbourne after becoming a priest and was sent on relieving work at Wonthaggi. A British Football Association exists in this town, the outcome of the large number of Scottish miners who have settled there since the mines were opened. One day it was stated the young priest, who is, by the way, also of Highland descent, so he's a Scottish Catholic, was watching the players in question at practice. He was asked if he could play. "Well, I don't mind trying," he answered modestly, only too eager to grapple at the invitation. He soon unfrocked and was sprinting around the ground with his remarkable alacrity, dodging, ducking, catching the ball on his cranium with precision, and complying with the requests of the Scotchman of "shoot one" when he had the ball anywhere near the goalposts. His reverence rarely missed the opportunity of placing the ball in the right position. That evening, much surprise and satisfaction was expressed at the wonderful showing of the priest, who was often playing after that until his relieving work was completed and he was transferred back to Melbourne. So that's a sad story. They enjoyed him playing, but unfortunately he was sent back to Melbourne. This has got a literary dimension to it, this story, hasn't it? It unfolds, and the writing is really kind of conscious of itself as writing.
Yes. Except for the people who forget to mention his name.
Yeah. I wonder if it's made up sometimes.
Well, look, that could be.
Yeah. Okay. When the soccer priest, as his name, not Billy or Johnny, was given a send-off by acquaintances, he expressed no little disappointment at leaving his Scottish brethren. few weeks ago, unable to suppress the anxiety of the soccer players. One Thaggy, you know, to suppress the anxiety of what's happened here, the soccer players, one Thaggy to get him back. No, that doesn't make sense. The reverend gentleman was called upon at his parish in a northern suburb and asked to sign a contract to go and play every Saturday for Thaggy. Is he a Collingwood or a northern suburb? He lives in Collingwood, but his parish is a northern suburb?
Yeah, possibly.
He has accepted the invitation, but a difficulty has arisen which might prevent him from completing the contract. You see, Father, the present parish priest, doesn't mind me going down every Saturday, he remarked, but we're going to have a change, and perhaps my next senior will have anything but a sporting mind, and then my little game will end. Imagine the popularity that would accrue if ministers of religion, such as the fighting parson and the footballing priest, went into the game actively and were permitted by the seniors to do so. Some little time ago, after the Queensland parson had carried off the amateur competitions, he was given a substantial offer to go to Melbourne and appear in the city. But, of course, he naturally declined to be staged in an exhibition bout, though undoubtedly he would have proved an exceptional draw and might have resulted not only in an attendance to the usual of the usual followers of boxing, but a clerical gathering representing all denominations, which would have had the effect of raising boxing generally in their estimation. It's a great little story.
And we don't know who he is.
Sorry?
And we don't know who he is.
No, but I'll make sure I find out.
You got Catholic networks. Don't you?
A direct line to the Popeye. Okay, so here we have someone who doesn't fit the mold.
Mm.
A Catholic priest, a soccer star, a Scottish Catholic priest, starring for one Thaggy.
But the Scottish thing is a Scottish thing. You know, I think is the clue.
Yeah.
If he was Irish, that'd be a real out of the box.
Yeah.
Kind of thing. But the fact that he's Scottish, I think, is probably the clue for why he ends up playing soccer.
So we've noticed that there is some Catholic soccer in New South Wales.
Yeah.
There's the Marist schoolboys competition in Newcastle. Then there's those Rechabites in Sydney.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are little pockets of Catholic soccer, but it's not, I mean, we always assume that Catholics in New South Wales tend towards rugby league. Catholics in Victoria tend towards, you know, some of the clubs like Collingwood, perhaps.
Richmond, North Melbourne.
Yeah, yeah. And we don't link them up with soccer in any way in Melbourne. But this guy's strongly linked. Mm. I mean, that it raises the issue of, you know, that's one of the things we don't perhaps talk about enough. In this book, Soccer in New South Wales, there's a whole section on religion and soccer. So Mosley recognised the importance of religious competition. But in the Victorian story, how do we, you know, where's religion, Catholicism fit?
Up to Second World War, I mean, from everything that we've discussed and whenever we do searches for things, it's so rare.
Yeah.
I don't really, cannot think of anything off the top of my head about priests or religion or anything. The most significant thing you can talk about in religion in terms of a Victorian context is Hakoa.
Yeah.
But that's a very different kind of situation, because that's the whole question of who are the Jews? Are they a religious group? Are they an ethnic group? A whole other kettle of fish. Obviously, in Victoria,
I think we do assume, though, that in the early days, soccer players were largely Protestant.
Yes.
And there probably weren't many Catholics. So there was probably a great deal of discrimination. Mm-hmm. Irish Catholics were seen to be the lower yeah. part of society, and soccer might well not have respected
people. Well, if you're talking about 1880s Melbourne soccer, where they're middle class, chances are that probably a lot of them are probably professionals of some sort.
Yeah.
Not necessarily part of the establishment, because I think that the establishment's already latched onto a different game and cricket more or less as well. But, you know, we think even after that, where the people in Melbourne playing soccer come from all sorts of different backgrounds, Catholicism doesn't, and Methodism and Wesleyanism and all of it, none of it can come. And I don't think we've seen it come up in the other states as well.
Sorry?
I don't think we've seen it come up in the other states.
No.
So it really only seems to come up in New South Wales, as far as I can tell. I'm not sure about Queensland.
Yeah.
I think everyone else is just glad to get a game of soccer.
Yeah.
And if they organise on locality or by regional, you know, British regional affiliation, that's something different than religion.
So when we think about the post-Second World War soccer in Victoria, with the large influx of Catholics, Italians, a little bit later Croatians, I'm not even a little bit later, you know, just probably in smaller numbers.
And Poles.
Poles, yeah. So there's the people who would tend to be Catholic. Do we talk about Catholicism and soccer in this later period?
I don't think that you can, because they're setting up Catholic parishes and churches or whatever within their own language groups, in their own ethnic groups. So they don't necessarily have connections. I mean, I had a very brief chat with somebody about this many, many years ago, I think a Croatian person. They're saying, look, the discrimination from the wider public was still there. It doesn't matter if they were Catholic. That kind of became sort of irrelevant. So much for brotherly love. But certainly the religions and this would go across all the ethnic groups across the country, and not even just for the Catholics, I mean for the Orthodox and whatever as well, where the religious ministers were focal organizing points for the clubs. In terms of especially their foundations, possibly as mediators in certain, you know, internal conflicts, I hazard to guess as well. But certainly the foundations were often held at a church, in the sense that, well, we're going to bless this new organization. It's going to be great for the community. We should all support it.
So it just fits into the community. So the organizing principles aren't religious. It just so happens that everybody involved in the club is Catholic.
Yes.
Yeah. And so it's just goes without saying sort of thing. If it were an organizing principle, then you'd be tempting people from outside the religion to come and, you know, make allowances for those people to come. Whereas it seems to me that there'd be sort of blanket religions, but, you know, no stress about it.
Yeah. And I mean, looking from the sort of the Greek perspective, from what I remember back in the old days, even through the NSL into the early days of the Victorian Premier League, once South dropped down, you'd still get the priest to come and bless the team at the start of the year. And one of our Muslim players would try to dodge the water being sprayed from the basil. you know, that's his prerogative.
Yeah.
But, you know, these things were fairly common, I would assume. But as sort of ethnic affiliation to both overt forms of religiosity and ethnic psyche has dwindled, these things are going to become much less important.
Well, my favorite memory of religion, it was also a favorite memory because South just absolutely smashed Melbourne Knights at Bob Jane, was the Knights supporters all down the Clarendon Street end.
I thought it was at the Lake End. If it was the smashing game 2006, that was the Lake End where they all got into a punch-up among themselves.
Oh, I'm confused now.
But there was a game where the game finished 2-2. That would have been about 2008, possibly, where it was coincided with the hosting of World Youth Day in Sydney.
Right.
And you had people turning up with Vatican flags.
Now, the game I'm thinking about was before the A-League.
So that was in 2005.
It was an NSL game.
NSL game. That's 2004. That's way back.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what smashing is this? I mean, there's so many of them. 4-0, 5-0?
I think it might have been 5-0, not 7-0. That's why you confused me earlier.
Okay.
But the whole point of this story is that in the Knights' End, someone had a framed portrait of the Pope.
Which was in John Paul II at the time, right?
Yeah, a big one, holding it up and, you know, chanting. And I thought, well, what a bizarre thing to bring. It's like you've taken it off the wall at home and brought it to the game. And it was so big. I don't know what they did with it while they were having a punch-up among themselves, but I hope they treated it respectfully.
I mean, it'd be interesting to delve into the quote-unquote Yugoslav clubs to see what, if any, kind of connections to religion that were there. I assume there'd be none.
Yeah, it's an interesting topic, Paul. And what's most interesting about it is that it doesn't seem that many people have thought about it in any depth.
And I think part of it is because among ethnic communities, looking at post-war soccer, we tend to view these things as essentialist.
Yeah.
So if you're Croatian, you're Catholic. If you're Greek, you're Orthodox. And that famous for refrain from the old South forums, if you're not Greek, if you're not Orthodox, you're not Greek. But these things became essentialist. It was just assumed. There was no difference.
Yeah.
And so therefore the way they organized them among themselves was obviously along ethnic lines.
Yeah.
Or in the case of Italian clubs, among regional lines, in a lot of cases, say Melbourne. Religion is not the main concern. Even things like, I had friends who played for Catholic, in Catholic school system, soccer, school tournaments. And obviously, we know in Melbourne that the two main Catholic schools, the two elite ones, don't play in the same competition as their poorer brethren. But my mates played in, the mainstream Catholic competition. But this was in an era where, despite the fact that a lot of them would have been Italian boys and Poles and whatever, there was still opposition to them playing soccer. Yeah. So you would have thought the Catholic school with a high migrant population, interested in soccer, would have been more tolerant or encouraging of them taking up the game and, representing the school, and they weren't.
So it's not really Catholic teams versus Protestant teams or something like that. It's Catholic sport, excluding other sports, excluding non-Catholic sports.
Yeah, sort of, yeah.
Yeah.
It's... Just because there were a lot of Catholics doesn't mean they're all in it together.
Yeah. Well, I know Xavier now that soccer's really quite strong.
Mm.
But who's
playing soccer there?
A lot of Italian boys.
Right, and the Greek boys.
Yeah.
The Wogs.
Yeah.
The ethnics.
Yeah.
So when we went to Xavier, when we watched one of your boys play, there was a clear delineation between the social groups. Not completely clear cut, but more or less of a trend. The Australian rules team was mostly Anglo.
Yeah.
The soccer team was mostly not.
Mm.
And the rugby union team was fat.
and some really good athletes as well. Often Pacific.
Yes.
Yeah.
Again, that's another ethnic group though, isn't it?
Yeah. So we're sort of waffling a bit now, Paul, maybe.
Yeah, I think we've run out of time anyway.
Yeah. But I would be really interested in someone who felt they could, educate us on this, let us know more about the religious dimension, because it does seem to be understated, even though it's important to the people involved in all the clubs, fundamentally important to a lot of the people.
Mm.
It doesn't seem to get a look in terms of club identity.
No.
Or club difference, yeah.
Again, there's an essentialist quality in the post-war frame of things, but in the pre-war, it really depends on the region. If soccer is not strong enough to get enough numbers, then there's really no point in quibbling about what religion someone is.
Yeah, all right. Well, next week we're going to be trying to get Gary McKenzie on, aren't we?
Oh, this is, I mean, it's not even going to be about soccer, is it? It's going to be about almost everything but soccer.
Yeah. It's a man without principles.
Yes. So hopefully we can get Gary on next week, and hopefully you can all join us. But for now, it's farewell.
See you later.